Judge Clary, Judge Werke, the Honorable Carol A. Hooton presiding.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Please be seated. Welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. The first matter on this morning's calendar is the case of Leonard A. Wallace versus BNSF Railway Company. Counsel, you each have 15 minutes for your oral arguments. The appellant will have 5 minutes for rebuttal. And you may proceed at this time.
Thomas Fuller on behalf of the appellant, and good morning. Members of the court, the judgment below should be reversed because the district court failed to properly apply the summary judgment standard in an FELA case, ignored substantial record evidence showing BNSF's negligence, and decided an FELA causation question, which is specifically reserved for the trier of fact. When looking at the district court's order, it acknowledges on page 7 that to this case, or to this court, it turns on the facts. The district court also says that by contrast, in weighing the evidence in favor of BNSF, says in contrast, there's nothing, makes a factual finding, nothing that BNSF could do to prevent Mr. Wallace's injuries. And I submit to the court that there is ample record evidence showing that there is at least three things that the BNSF could have done to prevent and was negligent, that a jury could decide negligent in this case. The first is that they provide a dangerous product, the deep creep. When looking at the material safety data sheet for the deep creep, it says that it is specifically to be used only for engine use. Yet BNSF, its supervisors, Ben Peterson, allow its welders, like Mr. Wallace, to use it for what purpose? An unintended purpose to ensure that the truck that has 300,000 miles on it, that is rusted, corroded, is able to work and open properly. In essence, to get into his office, to use this welding truck, which they take across, you know, all over the Duluth area in order to get to specific tracks where they need to weld these switches together, they have to use this unsafe, flammable product just to be able to get inside and to use the gate that comes down from it. There's pictures to the addendum, which you have seen.
The way I'm understanding your argument, you're not making a claim that BNSF was the sole cause of the injuries to your client. What you're saying is that we need to step back and have a jury determine if they were a contributor to the incident.
Absolutely, Your Honor. I will acknowledge that the PI report says what it says. Mr. Wallace, with his hands burned severely, he's filling it out as a layperson. He is not sophisticated and versed in what the FELA causation standard is. And so to take his PI report and to say, you knew it, you said it was your fault, therefore sole cause is on you, Mr. Wallace, this is a matter of contributory negligence that should be weighed by the jury. So a jury may say, you know, Mr. Fuller, Mr. Wallace, you know, you said in your PI report that you accidentally got this on your hand, and then you kind of got close to this area where there's sparks, and so we're going to put some fault on you. But the jury may also say, Mr. Railroad, BNSF, why don't you have a protective screen there? We know we have them, but you don't have one in this instance. How about just putting some flame retardant welding pants instead of the blue jeans? You know, they boast in their brief about the personal protective equipment that they have. Well, this is really more for steel toes, eyewear, but there's nothing specific for Mr. Wallace in order to ensure that his blue jeans aren't catching on fire.
Could I ask you, is there anything in the record that indicates that the railroad knew that this creep was being used in this manner, that the superiors knew that?
Yeah, it's Ben Peterson's deposition, Your Honor. And then when I took Ben Peterson's deposition, and that's document 23, it's the Fuller affidavit, and the full transcript is at Exhibit 6, and he testifies that this is allowed, they're supposed to use it, and this wasn't some decision that, you know, Mr. Wallace went out on his own and did something contrary to company policy to pick up this deep creep. He bought it, or may have bought it, from an L&M store, but with the BNSF, you know, card on the account. And so it was an approved product.
I think one of the arguments that was made is everyone knew that this product was flammable, and a lot of the other alternatives would have been flammable. So why would it make a difference here?
I think that goes to BNSF's notice as well. So if it's going to be foreseeable to Mr. Wallace that this is a dangerous product. It's the same standard for the BNSF. They know that it's a dangerous product. They can foresee that it shouldn't be used. And so again, back to Judge, the question earlier, it's all part of contributory fault.
Well, we hear a lot of BNSF cases, but it's the first time I've heard them called Mr. Railroad, so I kind of like that it's easier. So Mr. Railroad, though, would provide soap to, I'm talking about the tools now, because your guy's responsible for maintaining and cleaning their own tools, and they're rusty, and that's why they use Deep Creep. So what was the reasoning behind not providing Deep Creep, but providing soap, which doesn't do the job, according to the information I read?
Well, the reason for the Deep Creep is that the truck and the tools got so corroded and so rusted that they were unsafe, that they needed this, you know, extra product in order to get it done.
But Mr. Railroad expected that it would get done.
They required it. And so to do it, the position is you don't provide them with this unsafe product, or you provide them with a scheduled time in order to do the maintenance where it's not on the job site when sparks are flying around. But again, I'd submit that those questions are for the jury to resolve and don't absolve the railroad at all of their duty as a matter of law. Because, again, we're weighing the facts in favor of Mr. Wallace, not in favor of Mr. Railroad. And so when we're taking the facts in the light most favorable to Mr. Wallace, as the court must and as Mr. Warner and the railroad will agree, then you find substantial record evidence to show that a jury could find. Now, they may not. They may not. They may say, you know, this PI report, you know, this is 100% on Mr. Wallace's fault. But, again, even the cases that the railroad cites when it comes to sole cause, the majority of the sole cause cases they cite, they go to the jury. And so,
well, can I just take what the respondent has argued? And the respondent's basically saying that the sole reason that this occurred was because your client did not, he could have gotten some fire retardant clothing on, but he chose not to, that he used the creep when his real job was to clean the tools, but his real job was to watch the welder and to watch for other trains. I'm sure I'm missing something, but there were a number of arguments made that he should have been doing this or that.
Right.
What facts do you have that would at least create a factual issue as to the points raised by the respondents? I mean, what can you point us to in the record that would create an issue of fact?
Well, I think that we have to start above that, aside from the rule violations, assuming they are rule violations, first of all, because I'd submit that under the FVLA, those are classic assumption of the risk arguments that are being raised now that have been violated. But as for a specific citation to the record, if you look at, again, document 23, this would be Exhibit 6, Ben Peterson's deposition at page 75. Are you aware of any specific rule violations that Mr. Wallace committed on April 28th? No. No. There's a fact issue right there. Again, I would also submit to the court that these are credibility determinations for the jury to make, not for the court to weigh at the summary judgment stage. And these rules really amount to don't get hurt.
Well, but what about the fact that there were some, you know, flame retardant clothes available that he could have picked up?
And then I'll go back to the FVLA's non-delegable duty. They can't delegate to Mr. Wallace to determine what the safe protective equipment is for him to wear. And this allegation that, well, if he would have asked, we would have provided it to him. They have a duty to provide him with safe tools and equipment. They breached that duty by not...
Would have asked and they would have provided flame retardant work clothes or just...
It's my understanding from the deposition testimony that they did not provide him with the flame retardant pants, but they claimed in deposition testimony, well, if he would have asked, we would have given it to him. And so my point to that is, factual issue number one, you didn't provide it. You got a duty to do it. You acknowledge you didn't provide it. And then to say that it's on Mr. Wallace to decide or determine what tools and equipment are required of him to make the job safe, again, it turns the FVLA on its head and puts the duty on Mr. Wallace, which under Bailey and a whole host of cases, it's a non-delegable duty that the railroad cannot, you know, turn over to its employees. Really, you know, it becomes, this is essentially what the FVLA was enacted for, you know, since 1908, was for the railroad putting a duty on them to provide a safe place for their workers, not for the railroad to say, well, if you need something that you think you need to do to make this safer, let me know.
Well, can I ask you this? You said, I mean, the testimony was that if they would have asked, the clothing was available. I'm not sure. Was there clothing? I mean, was this flame retardant clothing known to the employees, and was it at some accessible place where they could pick it up, or
I don't
was
see
there any kind of rules or regulations regarding when you wear it or when you don't wear it?
As far as I know, Your Honor, the rules and regulations are that we have personal protective equipment, and it included a variety of different things for welding, eyewear, shields, but it did not specifically mandate that they wear a flame retardant pant. And so Mr. Wallace is left to his peril to decide which clothing to wear. And so I do believe that the record is sufficient on the issue that, you know, there are these products available, yet they just did not provide it. And I think that's a big, it's an important issue because.
Well, and I want to make sure I understand what the record shows. So you say they did not provide, is that the equivalent, or they did not require that they wear it? I mean, that's two different things.
Let me follow up on that, because here's what, yeah. I was going to ask the same question. Here's what we have from district court. He, meaning Wallace, also knew that wearing denim pants rather than the fire-resistant welding bibs that are supplied by BNSF.
The record, in my view, is devoid of that statement. That is that Mr. Wallace can't go into a supply closet and say, should I wear the jeans or should I wear these, you know, really safe pants? What was said is, and this, I believe, is at Peterson's, Exhibit 6, Peterson's deposition, pages 13 through 14, 22, and 81, where they talk about, you know, if he would have asked, we could have gotten them and provided them to him. But this wasn't something that he was required to wear and didn't wear, if that's the question.
Well, and I'm just trying to understand what the record shows, because, I mean, it's one thing if like what Judge Werke described, that they go to a locker room every morning and all this equipment is out and ready to go, and this clothing is ready to go. It's another thing if someone knows that somewhere they might have this or that. I mean, I don't know what the situation is. What in this record is there about the availability of flame retardant clothing?
Only if he would have asked, they could have gotten it to him.
I can't glean this from the record. He also knew he was wearing denim pants. So is this a guy, does the record show that he came to work and just didn't want to get changed and came from home? And
absolutely not.
Is there anything in the record that indicates how this determination of which pair of pants he was going to wear or which bibs came about?
This is not the situation where you're donning, you know, your equipment before you're going into work, essentially. There's nothing in the record that says you come into work, here's your welding gear, it includes these options.
But I mean, are these his home clothes, or what are street clothes, I guess is what I'm trying to say. You wear street clothes to work and that's what you go to work in, or did he go there and put on denim pants that were not his denim pants?
They were his denim pants.
That's what I didn't know, if it was his street clothes that he came to work in and just kind of kept them on and went about his job.
I'm sorry for the misunderstanding. He was wearing his own denim pants along with the other PPE that is provided by the railroad, steel-toe boots, glasses. You know, they also provide, I believe, there's like welding helmets. But my point is that they did not provide him with what they should have, which is the flame retardant pants or a protective screen. He was not in violation of any railroad rule by wearing the denim pants that he had on. And that's confirmed again by Mr. Peterson, who says.
And was that the usual attire that he wore whenever they were welding? And
yes, that's the custom and practice in what they were wearing on a regular basis. See, my time's dwindling down, but I would just like to touch on again that these are, you know, when the record is viewed as a whole, and it has to be viewed in its entirety, you know, the creep alone, the material data sheet, the photograph showing the rust, the rusty tools, this is all undisputed in the record that these facts are there. It's also undisputed that they did not provide him with the bibs. They did not provide him with a protective screen. And so any one of these pieces of evidence alone, a jury could find that the railroad is partly responsible under the FVLA. Thank you.
May it please the court, counsel. My name is Stephen Warner, and I represent the respondent, BNSF Railway Company. The sole cause of the appellant's injury in this case was his own negligence.
Counsel, as long as you get started on that term, let's go back a minute now and examine the FVLA standard. Do you agree it's a relaxed causation standard?
I do.
Do you agree, going as far back as Rogers, that the question is whether the negligence of the employer played any part, however small, in the injury, which is the subject of the suit? You agree with that?
That's the FVLA standard that the Supreme Court has given us.
Right.
I would also point out, though, Your Honor, that in the most recent case directly addressing the parameters of the causation standard, which is McBride, the Supreme Court took pains to point out that the standard that they were essentially reaffirming from Rogers was not but-for causation. In fact, the dissent in that case specifically raised the specter of the standard being diluted to the point where it would be just but-for causation, and Justice Ginsburg, again, took pains to point out, no, this is not but-for, and a court, as the district court in this case, would be justified in a but-for causation situation in not submitting the case to the jury. So it is relaxed, but it's not but-for causation. The standard still requires actual causal connection between the railroad's conduct and the injury.
I agree with you on your review of McBride. So we have a 39-year-old employee who's badly injured and concedes his part in it, and we take the leap to calling that the sole cause of the injury. At least that's how I see the district court. Summary judgment in this context, in my mind, is highly unusual, really unusual. So I'm trying to figure out how we get around the fact that that your client, as argued by the injured employee, says such things as, well, he could have had flame retardant pants if he wanted them. Why weren't they provided in advance? Why isn't your client more proactive in avoiding these type of injuries? Now, I'm not saying the employee is without fault here. Clearly, he is. But the issue, again, is what did the railroad do or not do?
Well, I would make two observations in response to that question, Your Honor. Number one, the question of flame retardant pants really applies to welders when they're welding. People who aren't welding generally don't wear welding pants, a welding jacket, a welding hood, welding spats. They don't wear the big gauntlet gloves when they're not welding. They only do it when they are welding, which Mr. Wallace wasn't doing at the point in time when he sprayed deep creep on his pants. So really, the flame retardant clothing, I mean, I suppose the railroad could require all of its employees, no matter what they do, whether they're in the office, whether they're on trains, whether they're working on a crew, to wear flame retardant clothing.
Well, now I think we're getting into the highly improbable area when we say they should wear them in the office. I'm talking about the crew.
Right.
And I'm suggesting that a lot of these factors that led to this horrible injury were somewhat foreseeable, not only to the employee, but to the railroad as well.
Well, and with regard to the pants, that's point number one. Point number two is the evidence in the record, both Mr. Wallace's testimony at page 91 of his deposition and Mr. Peterson's testimony, is that BNSF will provide welding pants for you if you want them. What you have to do is you have to ask BNSF to order them. BNSF will order them. Then you have them, and they're yours.
Okay, then I got to ask, I seem to be, we're all hung up on the clothing issue, but this is important, too. So when you say they will provide flame-resistant welding pants, is this what the welders actually use, or
yes.
Do they have something over and above that?
Well, the welders
so
have.
Those are designated for the people that are actually doing what Mr. Wallace was doing until he.
Correct. What the welders are absolutely required to wear is a welding jacket, a welding hood. They have to wear spats, basically flame retardant things that come up to their shin, essentially, and they have to wear gauntlets.
They don't have to wear these bibs.
They don't have to wear welding bibs. They can. And some of it, as I understand it, depends on the type of welding they're doing. Some of it depends on what the weather is. You know, they're very hot.
Okay, so these flame retardant pants are not available on site. In other words, someone has to come ask, then they have to be ordered, and then they have to be brought in. Is that correct?
If you're an employee and you want welding pants, all you do is you tell BNSF, I want welding pants. BNSF will order them for you. You have them. They're yours. You take them wherever you go. You put them on the truck when you're going to a remote location. Mr. Wallace knew this. Mr. Wallace had, in fact, ordered welding bibs in the past from BNSF and been provided them. It just so happened that he didn't apparently like welding bibs, and so he didn't reorder them when his last pair wore out.
Well, a bib and a pants, are they something else? I mean, are they two separate things?
The bibs are just pants with a bib, a different way of securing them, basically.
Okay. Well, let's move past that a little bit, Fiona. Who provides the deep creep, the lubricant?
BNSF provides it in the sense that either you get it from the shop, from BNSF, or you stop at a store and buy it at a store that BNSF has an account.
Okay, and that's used to clean and maintain tools or to whenever a rust situation exists.
And with regard to the questions about providing a non-flammable product, soap is available. Soap can be used to clean the tools, the vehicles.
It doesn't do a very good job. I think everybody acknowledges that.
It's not a rust inhibitor, and that's the problem. That's why Deep Creep is available, because Deep Creep works on rust. Deep Creep is a safe product when it's used correctly. Appellant's argument is essentially like saying BNSF is negligent for requiring its employees to put gas in their vehicles because an employee could light a cigarette while they're filling up and start a fire. Well, gas is flammable. Gas can be dangerous. Gas is not dangerous when it's used correctly and in the right circumstances. And the same holds true for Deep Creep. In this particular situation, BNSF's argument for sole cause rests on where and when Mr. Wallace sprayed the Deep Creep. He had no reason related to the specific job task that they were doing on that day, welding a frog, to spray Deep Creep. There's no evidence or argument in this case that, for example, a locker door in the truck that had a tool in it had frozen up, so he had to spray it to loosen up the door so he could get a tool out. Nothing in the record.
Well, was there any, from the record, it seemed like the employees were responsible for cleaning these tools, right?
Absolutely.
And was there anything in the the regulations or anything that prohibited them from cleaning it, when they decided they had some downtime?
Well, on an active welding site, I would submit to you that the track welding rules prohibited them from doing it because the rules require the welding foreman to inspect for and remove combustible materials. Well, a flammable aerosol is combustible. The rules require the welding foreman to remove materials that could be struck by sparks. Essentially, when you're welding, you have to do a fire assessment on site to make sure that flammable stuff isn't in the vicinity, because everybody, and particularly welders, know that welding creates sparks and can cause a fire.
Your brief indicates that Wallace's duties as the helper watchman did not include performing routine maintenance on the vehicle or the tools. There wasn't a prohibition against that, but that was not a part of what he was expected to do?
Correct. Watchman is a very important job. when these guys are welding on, well, welding in general and welding on track in particular. He was both the train watch and the fire watch. His partner, Mr. Austin, was welding on track, and they get a track warrant. Supposedly, that all trains are subject to the warrant, but they have a watchman out there because sometimes engineers or conductors don't get the notice that the track is closed, that the track is fouled. This is an important job. It's an important safety job. He's supposed to be watching the track, monitoring the radio in case he hears that a train is coming so he can get his partner off the track, and watching for fires.
I just have to ask, though, because the response is, and you may have some good arguments that, you know, about why he's contributory at fault, but and that he didn't obey the rules. But when the supervisor was questioned as to whether he violated any rules, the answer was no. Doesn't that at least create a fact issue for the jury?
I would submit that it doesn't, because Mr. Peterson was not called to testify as a corporate designee. He was called as an individual. Mr. Peterson didn't speak on behalf of BNSF. His testimony is an admission by BNSF. Mr. Peterson just gave his opinion based on what he knew of the situation. It's not binding on BNSF. It does not.
But
I would submit it doesn't
create
a question.
He?
Yeah, he is his direct supervisor. And while we're talking about Peterson, I would also point out that Mr. Peterson testified with regard to this routine maintenance he wants that the welding crews are required to perform, that he allows his crews to perform that maintenance at the shop before they go out in the field in the morning. He allows the crews to perform that maintenance when they come back from the field in the shop, and he authorizes overtime for them if they can't get it done before they leave or after they come back. So any suggestion that Mr. Wallace had no choice but to spray deep creep for routine maintenance purposes while at a remote location while active welding was going on is just completely contradicted by the record evidence.
Counsel, one of the issues raised by your opponent is that BNSF used to have three people on the crew,
yes.
Welding crew. How long ago did they cut it back to two?
Number of years ago, more than 10 years ago, I believe, maybe 15 years ago.
So there used to be a lead welder, a second welder, and a welder helper. Is that right?
Right.
And the welder helper was eliminated?
Yes.
Okay.
Well, the third position was eliminated, and the backup welder became the welder helper. And I would, with regard to that claim, the argument appears to be that if there was a third person on the site, that third person would have been spraying deep creep, doing routine maintenance on the vehicle and tools instead of Mr. Wallace, who would have been the watch. The problem with that argument is anybody spraying deep creep on an active welding site is unsafe. The manpower cases all tell us that the absence of manpower has to create an unreasonably unsafe work environment. Well, in this situation, based on their argument, having a third person would have done nothing to make it less safe. It would have just made it unsafe for a different person who's spraying a flammable aerosol, petroleum-based aerosol, in close proximity to where welding is going on. So I would submit that the manpower issue is really a red herring. A few other things, the spark shield. Everybody who has testified in this case has conceded that they had spark shields with them. Mr. Austin indicated in his statement, I think at page 6, that they had them. They just didn't use them for frog welding. That's essentially what Mr. Wallace testified to. He said they had them. They used them for grinding. And at page 157 of his deposition, Mr. Wallace conceded that his partner, Mr. Austin, actually used a shield after Wallace got hurt when Austin was grinding. He had to grind on the weld to make sure it was smooth so there wouldn't be a derailment. So any suggestion that the spark shields weren't available or weren't provided, completely, again, contradicted by the record.
But was the decision to use the shield Mr. Austin's as the welder?
It was. With regard to frog welding, they have to use a shield when they use it when they do what's called thermal welding, because thermal welding creates a great deal more sparks in a different sort of it throws sparks differently. So they're required to use the shields when they're doing thermal welding, not when they're doing frog welding. They're just required to use it when they're doing grinding as part of the frog welding. The last couple things I'll talk about, because I see my time is running very short. Condition of the vehicle. If this case had any allegation that, for example, like in the Mead case that's cited in appellant's materials, that something about the vehicle, like the seat in Mead, had been an instrumentality in Mr. Wallace's injury, we have a different case probably. There's nothing like that here. The vehicle, the condition of the vehicle, had no direct causal connection to the injury. And this idea that we're essentially asking the court to apply assumption of the risk. Assumption of risk is an employee's voluntary, knowledgeable acceptance of a dangerous condition that is necessary for him to perform his duties. Here we don't have that because Mr. Wallace created the hazard. The railroad didn't. He created the hazard by spraying this flammable material while welding was going on. And doing so wasn't necessary for his job. There's just no evidence that he had to do it to perform the work that was assigned to him that day.
What wasn't it necessary for his job? It's just he didn't do it at a time that you deem appropriate.
Yeah, poor choice of words on my part. Okay. To perform the specific frog welding task that they'd been sent to Andover to do.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. I just want to follow up on a couple of those matters here. First of all, BNSF, under no uncertain circumstances, did create this hazard. They have the truck, they have the tools, they have the rust, they provide them the dangerous product. They set this up, and they put the trap out there for Mr. Wallace to get injured in. He acknowledges his responsibility. The railroad hasn't. They sit here and fight this employee who has worked for them for 19 years, and they fight him tooth and nail as he acknowledges his responsibility. By no means under the law is he the sole cause for judgment as a matter of law. And as Judge Cleary pointed out under Rogers and McBride, it is not a direct cause. We heard this argument about Mead and whether the truck was a direct cause. I heard that phrase. When I hear the phrase direct cause in the FVLA, I start kind of, you know, having attacks, I guess, a little bit, because it's approximate, no matter how small, under Rogers. And so when we look at all of these facts, our discussion today has centered around what? The facts of the case. The pants, the deep creep, whether it was unsafe, whether it wasn't, whether he violated.
Staffing.
What's that?
The staffing. You didn't mention, or we didn't talk about the staffing.
Right. The staffing, the reduced workforce.
But respondent counsel indicates that was 10 years ago they made that change.
I don't see any reason why the jury can't consider that they should have staffed it appropriately as they did 10 years ago. And then we probably wouldn't be in this situation in the first place. There's also a host of other issues from which a jury could draw some fault on the railroad, like the water hoses that I didn't mention but are in my brief that weren't working and functioning properly. And so there's no one there to come to his aid or rescue. So again, the theme of this is that, you know, there's 222 pages, I think, to my affidavit. There's another 100 submitted by the railroad. The arguments today and before the district court, these are factual issues which, under a common law negligence case, should be resolved by a jury to determine who's more at fault in this situation. When you add the FVLA, Rogers, McBride, and the cases of this court, Mead, Albee, Wirtz, Carlson, Gallagher is the 2013 Minnesota Court of Appeals case that's published. These facts, first of all, must be weighed in favor of Mr. Wallace, and under the FVLA, it's a substantial right to have the jury decide these issues. You know, respondents may have a great closing argument, but I submit they don't have a summary judgment, especially not under these facts and under the FVLA. I just have to touch on this notion that Mr. Peterson, who's the supervisor of the railroad, that somehow his testimony is rendered inapplicable because he's not binding on the company. First of all, that's not the law and that's not the facts of the case. Second of all, I'm very certain that I wouldn't be allowed to be calling Mr. Peterson, you know, to have interviews with him like the railroad. And so my point on that is that they treat him as a corporate person who can bind the company with his testimony. Because in practice, I am not allowed to contact him, and it's because they consider him as somebody who can bind the company. And even if he doesn't, I mean, his testimony belies the arguments that Mr. Wallace violated all these rules. If your supervisor tells you that you didn't, and now you come into court to try to say that you violated X, Y, and Z, which again are vague rules, nothing prohibited him at all from doing the maintenance at the time. It's like they want it both ways. We want you to do the maintenance, but if you do it at a time where you're going to get hurt, now we're escaping our liability. They most certainly don't escape liability at the summary judgment stage, and it's for the jury to determine. And unless there's any other questions, I'll leave it at that, and I appreciate the court's time today.
All right. Counsel, thank you. Excellent briefing and arguments today, and I don't say that for every case I have, but I do appreciate it. We will take the matter under advisement.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.